morning, folks. Welcome. This is Arnie Hackett in Raleigh. We have Alfred Christensen here from the ComServer Design and Strategy Group. He's going to be taking us through getting the most out of your OSA adapters with ComServer. Right, Alfred, take it away.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, this is Alfred. Good morning or good afternoon or good midday to all of you. I know you're all over the place this morning here. We decided this time for the webcast to review some of the later OSA enhancements that have been made available over the last few releases. There have been many of them, as you may have noticed if you have followed the individual release announcements. So we thought it would be a good idea to sum them all up and make sure you were aware of them, because some of them require you to make some changes in order to enable them and take advantage of them, obviously. So that's the objective of this session, to basically go through what has happened in that area. On page 3, for those of you who may be following in the PDF file instead of on the screen, brief agenda of what we're going to talk about, just very brief review of the OSA hardware. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about hardware, but we do need to make sure we understand where we are with the various hardware levels that are available today. A brief refresher on what QDIO is, and then we're going to dive into an area that traditionally has been rather complicated to understand and get right, and that's what we call OSA inbound routing. That's where we have all the OSA addressing table and primary router and secondary router. And I'm not going to dwell too much on the way it used to work. What I will try to convince everyone to do is to start using the new ways it works now, which are much simpler and easier to understand and explain to your peers that are doing network engineering jobs in your shops. So we're going to go through that. Then I will go through a set of selected OSA enhancements that have been made available in release 9, 10, 11, and 12, which just shipped here recently. And that's where we will spend most of the time. If we have the time, I will talk a little bit about network interface resilience and use of dynamic VIPers and what I call flat networks. It's a technology that some have been using over the years, mostly if they, for some reason, weren't able to use dynamic routing for various reasons. But what is a little bit interesting is that the new Z Enterprise, when we talk about what we call the inter-ensemble data network in that environment, will actually rely on those technologies for both OSA interface resilience and dynamic VIPER movements in that environment. So they kind of become a little bit more important than they were in the past. There are two appendixes in this material that I will not go through, because we won't have the time to do that. I did include them because they are actually quite interesting. One of them is about how you monitor your OSA adapters with SNMP MIP variables. And then the last appendix is one that talks a little bit about the configuration of OSA Express 3 multiple ports per channel path ID. Okay, let's take a brief introduction to the OSA hardware on page number 5. I did take a few liberties on this chart here to try and get everything into a single slide, because there's a lot of information here. But generally today we talk about four different generations of OSA Express, whereas the latest is the OSA Express 3 adapter. They have each been introduced with various levels of the system Z servers, where obviously the latest are Z10 and Z196, and that's where you find the OSA Express 3 adapter. In terms of actual network connectivity through the OSA adapter, we today focus obviously on gigabit Ethernet, 10 gigabit Ethernet, and 1000 base T. You actually need to go all the way back to the Z800, 900, 899, 990 to find token ring attachment in that environment. So we really don't focus a lot on token ring any longer. So just keep that in mind. I think most of you are off token ring, so it's probably not a big deal at all. OSA Express 2 can be used on Z10 and Z196 as carry forward, at least to the Z196. But there's also a statement of direction out at this point in time that says that that the Z196 is the last mainframe where you can use OSA Express 2. So you do need eventually to move on to OSA Express 3 hardware in your shop. So just keep that in mind. Okay. Page number 6 gives you a brief overview of the various OSA Express features, what is supported on them. Their most interesting part is probably the last part on this slide or this table here that talks about OSA Express 3, which are supported on both Z10 and Z196, but not on anything prior to that. As you can see, if you go up to the OSA Express 2 section of this table here, those adapters can be carried forward to the new hardware, but you cannot order them for the new hardware. So the new hardware is basically OSA Express 3 focused. And that in a sense, is really good, because if you go on page number 7 and 8, there's a brief comparison of performance throughput between OSA Express 2 and OSA Express. The first slide on page 7 talks about the gigabit Ethernet interface. And for standard frames, 1492 bytes, it seems that you can see there's actually a quite significant increase in throughput on OSA Express 3, whereas if you were using jumbo frames, they're not that much of a throughput increase with OSA Express 3 in this environment. If you go to slide 8, you have the same comparison for the gigabit Ethernet port, and that's where you really see the significant change between OSA Express 2 and OSA Express 3 adapter. You can quite clearly, for 1492 frames, it's a 520% increase in throughput, and for jumbo frames, it's a 156% increase. The interesting part here, though, is that with OSA Express 3 and 10 gigabit jumbo frames, and for that matter, standard frames also, you get very, very close to line speed, which you did not do with the 10 gigabit Ethernet interface in OSA Express 2. So I have said a couple of times in the past, I'm going to say it again, if you are thinking about moving to 10 gigabit Ethernet interfaces, do not waste your money on doing that on OSA Express 2. Do go straight to OSA Express 3 and get that feature on OSA Express 3. You'll get much more out of your money doing that, obviously, as you can see on these slides here. Brief review of OSA chip ID types and device drivers and a few selected operating systems on system Z. I left out some, you know, ZTBF and VSE from this chart here because it got utterly busy if I tried to include everything. But what is somewhat interesting here is to focus on what is still, I would say, a little bit strategic or in terms of actually still used. Now, the old chip ID type of OSE, well, that's a very old I/O model for how you communicate through the OSA adapter. It kind of mimics a traditional control device interrupt model. LCS is probably not used any longer. LCS was used for IP initially, as you may remember, all the way back to IBM 3172 and Cisco SIPs and things like that. What is still used to some extent is SNA connectivity through an OSA port, and that is the LSA device driver operation method you would use there. That, if VTAM needs direct access to a local area network for transporting SNA frames as frames on that LAN, basically what we call SNA, Logical Link Control Layer 2, then you need an OSA adapter operating in chip ID OSE and then an LSA mode. That is limited to copper-based OSA ports. So you can do that with the 1000 base T port only in the new OSA Express 3 environment. The next chip ID type that is of interest is OSD. That is QDIO. QDIO today come in two different flavors, what we call Layer 3 and what we call Layer 2. Layer 3 is the traditional QDIO used for IP version 4 and IP version 6, where the operating system is able to offload a number of specific functions into the OSA adapter. So in a sense, the OSA adapter cooperates with the operating system in performing certain network-related functions such as address resolution protocols and things like that. It gives a pretty good performance, obviously. QDIO Layer 3 is limited to IP version 4 and IP version 6. You cannot do anything else on QDIO Layer 3. QDIO Layer 2 was introduced a few years ago with the purpose of enabling other networking protocols through an OSD chip ID. Primary use of that is obviously something like Linux, where Linux may need to do SNA LLC 2, for example. It can do that over QGO layer 2. It could actually also do NetBIOS or whatever else you wanted to do, because in QGO layer 2 mode, the OSA adapter is network protocol transparent. It really doesn't care what type of network protocol it is that you carry in the frames that you send in and out over the OSA adapter operating in that layer 2 mode. Now, the good thing about QGO layer 2 compared to something like OSE is That obviously opens up for using the latest network attachment technologies, both gigabit and 10 gigabit Ethernet. So something like Linux, and this is actually a little bit odd, you might say, but something like Linux can actually communicate SNA LLC2 over a 10 gigabit Ethernet interface, whereas ZOS cannot do that. ZOS is limited to 1000 base T via the LSA interface, and that's a little bit odd, but that's just where we are at this point in time. ChipID OSN is what is used between a Linux running the 3745 emulator CCL and BTAM. That's basically looping back through an OSN adapter. I don't talk too much about that one, but basically what it is, it's a CDLC channel link protocol that is used on that. Then there is OSC ChipID. OSC ChipID is a console type of interface that enables the OSA adapter to appear to the operating system as an old-fashioned 3270 control unit with normal 3270 terminals attached to it. The way that the actual terminals, if you will, connect into OSA is through a telnet protocol. So the OSA adapter, in a sense, has a small telnet server running inside it to which you connect from your normal TN3270 clients in this environment. Now, up to the operating system, it's not TN3270. It is basically a channel link protocol that makes these terminals appear as if they were local 3270 terminals coming into to the ZOS or other operating systems. The good thing there is you can actually use that for IPL consoles and NIP consoles, as well as traditional non-SNA DFT terminals through VTAM, obviously. So this is actually a way you, even though you have no longer any real 3270 control units, you can still IPL from a 3270 terminal, if you will, on your system. There are two new chip IDs that were introduced with the C Enterprise environment. One is called OSM and one is called OSX. OSM is used for the C Enterprise internal management network, and it operates in QDIO layer 2. And the OSX is used for the internal or intra-ensemble data network, and that operates in QDIO layer 3. You could actually operate in layer 2 also if your operating system supported that for IPv4 and IPv6 for that matter. ZOS does support the OSM network in layer 2 mode for the OSM network only. It's the only use of layer 2 from a ZOS point of view. This is just a high-level overview of all these different chip ID types, and traditionally I would assume that you would use OSD. That's probably the only one you're using today. You may have a single OSE if you're using SNA out from VTAM to the LAN, but otherwise it would primarily be OSD you would be using today. Okay. Brief review on QDIO, page 11. Where did we come from and why did we do QDIO? Now, I mentioned LCS or LSA, the OSC chip ID, and I also mentioned that it kind of worked like an old-fashioned I/O model with what looked like a channel and a control unit and a network interface card. So you normally, when the operating system were to write data out onto the LAN, it would just build the traditional channel command words and change them together, issue and start channel program or whatever it would do to kick that channel program off. And then the data would go out through the channel to the control unit, and we would get the normal control unit end and device end interrupt back in processing this I/O. That model worked okay as long as local area networks were 4 megabit or something like that. When we really began getting into fast Ethernet and approaching gigabit Ethernet, this model could not follow any longer. It was impossible to get it to scale. And that was when QDIO was introduced. QDIO allows the network interface card on the OSA Express adapter to communicate directly into host memory. So we don't have this whole chain of components that need to get involved. When ZOS has data to write, it puts it into a piece of memory and sends a signal to the OSA adapter, and the OSA adapter copies it out and sends it out onto the LAN from there on. Similarly, when data comes in, the OSA adapter puts the data into host memory and does a PCI interrupt into system Z. So basically, we go off straight from there and process into there. So much more efficient model. Now, the difference between OSA Express 2 and Express 3 from this perspective is that OSA Express 3 improved the processing through the OSA adapter itself. So instead of actually the NIC card storing data within the OSA adapter and then the OSA adapter copying into host memory, data flows hardware-wise straight through the OSA adapter and up into host memory. And that is the main reason why you see those significant performance improvements for OSA Express 3 compared to OSA Express 2 in the previous chart. That's just high-level overview how it all works. Now, the way OSA and QDI work together, I mentioned QDO Layer 3, which is the way we traditionally operate an OSA port from ZOS TCP IP. QDO Layer 3 is for IP traffic only, right? And we sometimes refer to this as OSA IP Processing Assist or IPA. And what that means, as I mentioned earlier on, is that the TCP IP stack actually communicates various types of control information down to the OSA adapter. And then the OSA adapter will perform IP-specific functions, which you might say, well, that's odd because such an adapter would normally be at a layer below the networking protocol. But in this IP assist mode, the adapter is actually IP-aware and is able to perform a number of different functions. The most commonly well-known is obviously Address Resolution Protocol, ARP processing for IP version 4, and there are others, checksums for IPv4 and segmentation offload and whatever environment here. QDO Layer 3 does not support anything but IPv4 and IPv6, unless obviously you for SNA use Enterprise Extender, in which sense the data leaves the ZOS as IP packets. Or you can obviously also use TN3270 for SNA type of connectivity. Layer 2 mode is network protocol agnostic. It does not know whether this is IPAC or SNA frames or, for that matter, NetBIOS or IPX or whatever else you might want to communicate over that QDO port in this environment. ZVM supports and Linux supports QDO Layer 2. ZOS really does not support Layer 2 except for one specific chip ID types, which is the OSM chip ID. Otherwise, ZOS does not. You cannot configure ZOS TCP IP for IPv4 to use Layer 2, and you probably wouldn't want to do it either, because when you operate in Layer 2, the operating system has to do all the functions that Layer 3 allows it to download to or offload to the OSA adapter. So there would be a performance penalty, obviously, when compared to QDO Layer 3 for something like IP. It is meant for things like Linux to operate with other protocols than IP. And as mentioned earlier on, we definitely use it for some of the SNA solutions on Linux on System Z. Both OSA and QDIO have focused a lot on performance through the last many years, and as you will see a little bit later when we go through some of the enhancements, they are almost all of them are performance-related. So it's always a main focus for everything that is done in this area is to make sure things performs better and that things are configured dynamically so you don't have to go and deal too much with the details of how to get the most out of the OSA adapter. You do need sometimes to enable certain functions, but the exact details of it really is not something that you're going to be involved in. Jen has mentioned early on, 10 gig, 1 gig, and 1,000 base T Ethernet is what you have today. Those are the strategic network interface cards at this point in time. Now, some of the industry has already defined 40 gigabit. OSA is not there yet. It may get there one day, but we're not there yet. I have heard, though, that there are 40 gigabit cards available on some other platforms already now, but I also understand they do not run anywhere near 40 gigabit. So it's going to take a little while before we get to actually utilize or take advantage of those line speeds. Page 13, a little bit about QDIO and devices, which has always been a tricky area. ZOS communication server needs to have a mechanism over which the operating system can convey information to the OSA adapter, or the OSA adapter, which the OSA adapter will need in order to perform some of the offload functions. For example, the operating system needs to tell the OSA adapter that, oh, by the way, here is an IP address, and you are supposed to respond to ARP queries for this IP address. The way the operating system does that is via something what we call the control channel between the operating system and the O support. And if you look at the TRLE definition for an O support, two device numbers there, read and write, those are the control channel. So read and write are not the devices that your data is being transmitted over, you know, read and written over, which you might have expected. Those are the two device numbers that are used for the control communication between operating system and the OSA adapter. Now, there is one control channel, basically this pair of numbers, independently of how many network interfaces you define in this LPAR that use that OSA port. Right? So there's only one set of device numbers for the control channel, no matter how many network interfaces you have defined. Data is exchanged over the data devices, and where you define that is in the data path keyword in the TRLE. So in this example, you have four device numbers. That means that four data paths can be opened and share this O support, this TRLE, on this operating system instance you have here. So the question is, who uses a data path? Well, if you define an IPv4 interface with the old device and link, that would normally take up a data path. You can define a single IPv6 interface using the same OSA port, and the combination of an IPv4 device plus link and an IPv6 interface can share a data path. That's really an oddity. And if we were to go back and redo some of the designs we made in the past, we probably wouldn't do it that way. Because it's a little bit confusing. The general rule I want you to go away with here is that an IPv4 interface, if you define it with the interface statement, takes up a data path. And an IPv6 interface, by that matter, also defined with the interface statement, takes up another data path. Right. So that would be the general rule I want you to go away with, because another section of this presentation is going to talk a little bit about device link versus interface statement for IPv4, and I want you to move to interface statement for IP version 4 and kind of drop the device link definitions. But in this example you have here, we have a TCP IP1 stack that has one device link defined for IPv4 and another device or interface defined for IPv6. That would take up one data device. If you have another stack that defines an IPv4, actually two different IPv4 interfaces with two different interface statements, that would be two data devices. So in this scenario here you have right now, we actually use three of the data devices that were reserved in this TRLE. Which one goes to who doesn't really matter, right? There just has to be enough of those data devices in the data path statement in the TRLE to meet all the requirements. One thing you need to keep in mind is that if you enable the OSA network traffic analyzer trace, where you ask the OSA adapter to trace packets down very close to the network interface card in and out of the OSA port, then the TCP/IP stack that activates that trace and receives all the trace packets from the OSA adapter will require an extra data device for that purpose. So you need to make sure that your data path supports, obviously, all the interfaces, real interfaces, if you will, that your TCP/IP stacks will define. But there has to be one extra if you want to use this OSA network traffic analyzer trace, because that's going to take one extra for that purpose. Okay, this was hopefully a refresher, but this is a little bit of a complicated area, I know that. We're moving to 15. I want to set a few things straight about this OSA and so-called inbound routing. I have read many documents over the years that talks about OSA being a router. OSA is not an IP router. Let me just emphasize that. It's not a full-function IP router. It has logic to look at the IP address in a packet that comes into it, and then it can compare that to a table it calls the OSA addressing table and ask which LPAR and data device does this packet go on to. So it's basically a kind of a deep multiplexing function it has. A packet comes in, it looks at destination IP address, says, this IP address belongs to LPAR 3 TCP/IP stack number 1, for example, and another one belongs to LPAR 2 and some other TCP/IP stack in there. OSA does not participate in dynamic routing updates. It has no idea what OSPF or RIP is. The only thing it knows is what the TCP/IP stack tells it through the IP assist functions in terms of updating this OSA addressing table it maintains for this specific purpose here. Okay. Originally, and this is where the changes come in, and this is where life is becoming easier because this is no longer the case, but originally, the OSA network interface card has a single physical hardware address, a single MAC address. But that means that all packets that come in to that OSA port has one destination MAC address in it, in them. And that case, that's where the OSA looks into the IP header of that frame and then looks into its OSA addressing table and says, who does the packet go to? So it actually demultiplexes, if you will, that way in. If ZOS is an IP router that routes to networks behind ZOS, the destination IP address in the packets that come to this OSA port actually do not belong in any of the LPARs that share the OSA port. But the IP addresses belong to some nodes that sit behind ZOS on another network behind ZOS. And in that scenario, there is nothing in the OSA addressing table that says, this IP address belongs to this TCP IP stack.
Right.
That's where setting up OSA in this type of environment becomes really cumbersome. And there are some limitations, actually things you cannot do. And a lot of you have burned your fingers on this throughout the years. And the only thing I can say right now is, you know, life is going to be easier for you if you do what I tell you in a few slides ahead here, right? So just don't despair too much right now because this is the way it used to be. This OSA addressing table is used both when OSA port operates in the old LCS mode and when it operates in QDIO layer 3 mode. The main difference is that if you operated in OSA in OSE LCS mode, you update the OSA addressing table through OSA SF interactions, right? So if you move a dynamic VIP address from one part to another, you better be fast going down and update the OSA addressing table if you use LCS for the OSA adapter to know where to send the packets. When you operate in QDIO mode, TCPIP does this dynamically for you. And that's where this IP assist stuff comes in. That's what this QDIO control channel that is used for the operating system as soon as an IP address moves into one of the TCP IP stacks in the sysplex will just tell the OSA that, this IP address is over here now instead of over there, and you don't need to do anything in order to update that OSA addressing table. So QDIO is much easier when you use this OSA addressing table for inbound IP routing, but it's still depending on the OSA addressing table. So I tried to come up with a slide that will give you just an overview of the role of this OSA addressing table. And in order to understand that, I need to kind of start explaining or maybe expanding my explanation a little bit. The OSA addressing table in the OSA adapter is really used for at least two different purposes. One is for inbound routing. So basically, the packet comes in. If you look at the left illustration at the bottom of this slide here, a frame comes in destined for the OSA port MAC address, and then the OSA microcode looks into this OSA addressing table to say, this destination IP address, IP1, for example, it belongs to LPAR1, and IP2 belongs to LPAR2. That's what they call inbound routing, and that's one of the purposes of the OSA addressing table. If you look at that purpose and look at LCS versus QDIO versus QDIO with virtual MAC addresses, and that's a new thing we're going to talk a little bit about here, then the OSA addressing table is actually not used any longer when you use virtual MACs with a sub-option that is called Route All. Route All means for virtual MACs that if a given TCP/IP interface has defined a virtual MAC and a packet comes into the OSA port with this virtual MAC, give it to that TCP/IP stack no matter what IP address is in the packet. Right? And that's where we kind of get rid of the OSA addressing table from an inbound routing point of view. Now, the other purpose of the OSA addressing table is to keep the OSA port informed about which IP addresses to respond to ARP processing for. So basically, which IP addresses to respond to an ARP query for and which to send ARP gratuitous ARPs and things like that for. And that's the other purpose. And that is still used with virtual MACs. So the OSA addressing table does not disappear because we start using virtual MAC addresses, but it reduces its use to only deal with the ARP processing and not necessarily with the inbound routing. You can still ask the OSA adapter to only give packets to an LPAR if that LPAR has registered its home IP addresses in the addressing table and the destination IP address match one of those, right? That's what we call route local. I normally don't recommend doing that. I normally recommend specifying route all and then use that with virtual max. That is the simplest way of operating an OSA adapter today. We'll get a little bit more back to this. So basically, virtual max in Qdaro Layer 3 mode, there was a new technology that came out a few years ago that you can do this. You enable it on your definitions by just specifying vMAC. You can either specify exactly what the MAC address is you want to use, and I normally don't do that. I let the OSA adapter generate the MAC address for you because you don't care what that MAC address is. It's not like with this that you need to know what the MAC address is. For TCP IP, you don't care what the MAC address is as long as it is unique, so you normally don't need to know what it is. The point here is that out on the network, on the local area network, frames will have these MAC addresses in them. And that means that the OSA physical port will receive frames for multiple different MAC addresses. Right? So if you want to do, for example, sniffing and want to filter on specific MAC addresses instead of IP addresses, basically look upon which frames are going to one specific ZOS TCP IP network interface, no matter if they are for to be routed or they belong to that, then you can just sniff or filter on that destination MAC address that belongs to that ZOS TCP IP image, which makes life a little bit easier for the network engineers, obviously. You can either code the MAC address directly or you can ask the OSA adapter to generate it. I recommend letting the OSA adapter do it. All IP addresses are advertised with that virtual MAC, either with ARP or Network Discovery for IP version 6. All routers will forward frames to the virtual MAC. So they also will actually receive all of these frames that come with these different MAC addresses. That also means that all stacks can now be routing stacks instead of just one primary router stack. In fact, the whole primary router, secondary router, becomes obsolete with virtual MAC address. You can forget totally about that. There are no limitations there. You can use this on Z9, 10, and Z196. In releases prior to release 10, there was a limitation that a given stack could define one virtual LAN per protocol for an OSA port. Now, that basically meant one vMAC also for the link interface and one vMAC for the interface statement. Now, that changed in release 10 so that you can now have up to 8 VLANs. So basically, a given TCP IP stack can now be represented on the network, if you will, with 8 different VLANs, and by that, 8 different virtual MACs if you want to do that in this type of scenario. As I put in this little call-out box here, I really see no reasons to not use virtual MACs. I think they are a great invention. They make the OSA adapter operating in Layer 3 mode more or less work the way we wanted it to have worked since the early 90s, is really what it is. It makes it look normal, if you will, from a network point of view. So I really recommend you do that. Now, I already mentioned virtual LANs. So let's look a little bit upon what virtual LANs are. Virtual LANs is a mechanism to virtualize the LAN hardware, if you will. Generally, an OSA port would be connected to a switch, and anyone who shared that OSA port would have an IP address on the same subnet because they were all on one local area network. When we operate in VLAN mode, that single OSA port can represent many different IP subnets. And which subnet it represents is determined through which VLANs each individual TCP IP stack belongs to. So in this example here, you've got 4 LPARs. You use VLAN ID number 2. LPAR 2 and 3 use VLAN ID number 3, and LPAR 4 use VLAN ID number 4. Over that OSA port, single physical port, single cable into the switch, that is 3 different IP subnets that have nothing to do with each other. The switch have to define the OSA port in trunk mode, which is a definition on the switch. It basically says that the OSA port knows a VLAN tag because within each frame it's going to be a little VLAN tag that says, oh, this frame belongs to VLAN ID number something, something, right? And then the O supporter is going to actually demultiplex that and figure out which L part does it belong to. But it means that from a switch point of view, it will send frames onto that cable or that fiber with VLAN tags, and it's going to expect to receive frames from that adapter with VLAN tags on it. The opposite is an access mode switch port. In an access mode port, the switch will actually strip off the VLAN tags because there's a definition on the switch that says whatever is connected to this port belongs to a specific VLAN ID, and they are not VLAN aware out on that port. So that would act, so the switch will remove the tag for anything that goes onto that LAN, onto that port, and whatever comes from that port will be assigned a tag before it goes further on into the network. So in this example here, you really got what I call a hardware diagram that shows this topology here. If you look at the right side of this slide here now, you can depict that also by a logical network diagram that looks quite different, if you will, because you've got your four LPARs now, where LPAR 1 is assigned to one VLAN, 2 and 3 to another, and 4 to a third. The point here is that those are three different IPv4 subnets, right? There is no connectivity between those virtual LANs, those subnets, unless you put in routers that have interfaces on both of these two VLANs. Then you can route from one VLAN to the other VLAN. So, from an IP topology point of view, this is really a routed environment, three different VLANs and two different routers. From a hardware point of view, it's all shared in a single cable and a single switch, if you will. The VLANs allow you to split your hardware up and use it for different purposes that where you want to separate some of the traffic. Now, VLAN technology in general has not always been considered, you know, a security technology, because if I have a trunk port into my ZOS OSA port, then any LPAR can basically say, oh, I belong to VLAN ID number 2, or I belong to VLAN ID number 3. So there's really no policing of that. One of the main changes in this area is the Z-Enterprise that enforces VLAN memberships through microcode. So in the Z-Enterprise environment, the intra-example data network, the microcode will actually enforce which operating systems may belong to which VLANs, and that's one of the main differences. We're not going to go too much into that today, but I just want to make sure that you're all aware of that. So VLAN is really a LAN media virtualization technology that allows you to take whatever hardware you have and carve it up from an IP topology point of view that is totally different from the way the hardware looks. Right? There's lots of good things with VLAN technologies, but let's not go too far in there. I talked about this multiple network interfaces per OSA port. We changed that in release 10 so that you can actually now on a single OSA port define three different VLANs. So the right side of the lower part of this little illustration here shows a single 10 gigabit Ethernet port with three different interface statements that define three different VLANs with three different MACs and three different subnets. But they're all using one single OSA port, obviously. Now, in order to do this, you must use the new interface statement. Now, most of you probably define from historically define QDR interfaces with device link statements. Since release 10, you can define QDIO IPv4 network interfaces with the interface statement. It's a different syntax where you, in a sense, convert device, link, home, and maybe BSA routing paths into a single statement where everything is configured on that single statement. It has a lot of advantages for various purposes, and let's not go into all of those right now. Point is that I really want you to start thinking about converting your device link for QDIO IPv4 to interface. And one of the reasons for that is that some of the newer functions we're implementing are based on the interface statement, things you cannot enable unless you have the interface statement. That's not just because we thought it was easier. It is also from a logical point of view because there's more information in the interface statement at an earlier point in time during TCP/IP initialization that we early on could depend on because these definitions were spread out of all these different configuration statements. So my point here to you is I want you to go and look at this. I want you to go and look at your interface statement and change the device link to interface statements. It's not a big deal. You just need to go through it and get it done, obviously. Page 21, high-level view of how OSA inbound routing works. There's only one little note here, and that is that if an O support, if you have TCP/IP stacks that share an O support, and one stack use VLANs and the others do not, it becomes utterly, utterly complicated. So my general recommendation to keep things simple is that if you start using VLANs, then make all stacks or all interfaces that share the O support use VLANs. Then you can figure out what is going on. If you begin mix and match, things get very, very complicated. So this little chart here, that basically shows you how does the OSA adapter decide where a frame goes when it comes in. And the easiest, basically saying, you know, is the VLAN ID in the frame? Yes. Do we have a VLAN ID match? Do we have a VMAC match? Yes. Is route all? Yes. Then give it to the selected interface, network interface, right? So VLAN ID or no VLAN ID, will VMAX route all, we go straight to that network interface, to that LPAR. And that is obviously the way that we want you to go. Okay. Going to go on to page 23, talk about a few specific things. First, I will talk about something that's really not new, but something that continues to confuse many of us, and that is this maximum transmission unit, or MTU. You know, what is the size really, as I say here? And the issue here is that there are actually four different definitions of what MTU is. There's something which we call the interface maximum transmission unit. That value is either what you configure on the interface statement in TCP/IP or what the actual hardware device reports when it is being activated. So it's either something you have said or it's something that the OSA adapter says, I'm capable of doing this, right? For example, if you have a gigabit Ethernet interface, it's going to say, oh, I'm capable of doing jumbo frames, right? Now, if you have defined interface statement also an MTU of jumbo frames, then, well, that is going to be the interface MTU, right? This value is what is reported in your DevLinks ACT MTU, and you might think ACT MTU stands for actual MTU. It is actually not the MTU that will be used when you transmit data on this. This is just basically what is the activation MTU, if you will, of this interface we have here. Then comes the next level here, and that is the configured route MTU. So now you have an interface MTU that basically says this interface is capable of doing this MTU size, right? Then there's the route MTU, and let's forget static routes. Dynamic routes are more interesting for most of you. Dynamic routes, for a dynamic route, the interface or the configured route MTU will be the MTU, the actual interface MTU, from the interface over which OMP route heard about this destination. So if MP route hears of a destination through, for example, the OSA interface, and it is currently running with an actual or interface MTU 8 of jumbo frames, that is going to become the configured route MTU for the routes that will learn over that interface. If there is no MTU defined in OMP route, then the default value of it, because in OMP route, you define your interface definitions in OMP route, and that's where you actually specify an MTU size on the OSPF interface statement in OMP route. And that's where, if you don't do that, OMP route will use a default value for IPv4 of 576 and 1280 for IP version 6, right? So whenever you see a configured route MTU with 576, that is because you had an OSPF interface over which the destination was learned that did not have an MTU coded on that OSPF interface, right? So this does not come from the interface MTU. Now, the actual route MTU is where we combine the two, because the actual route MTU is the lowest of the two. So if you had the interface MTU, that was jumbo frames, but the route MTU had been configured on an OSPF interface statement to maybe use 1492 or 1500, then the lowest of those two will become the actual route MTU. If you don't enable path MTU discovery, that is the MTU size packets will be sent with for that destination. If you enable path MTU, then we'll start sending packets with the actual route MTU, and then we will react to updates we get from the network and modify that route MTU to the MTU discovered MTU size. So interface MTU is reported in belt length. The others are really reported either through OMP route displays or through the routing table displays. And what you see in the routing table display is either the actual route MTU or the MTU that was discovered by path MTU. So this is confusing. You can even I can get it wrong when I sit here and go through it. But this is confusing. Just keep your eyes open for this. It is a confusing area. If you see lots of reassembly or fragmentation going on, especially in a source VIPER, SysPlex distributor type of environment, where you see, for example, a lot of fragmentation occurring on the SysPlex distributing LPAR, well, that might be an indication that you're not using path MTU, and I would recommend that you enable path MTU. That could actually deal with that for that specific environment. Okay. Dynamic LAN idle timer. That is a performance-enhancing capability for inbound processing from OSA. OSA and QDO has always had this little dilemma saying, you know, are we going to just make sure that we process lots of packets efficiently so we use the CPU cycles of ZOS efficiently, or are we going to try and keep as low latency as any way possible by making sure that as soon as a packet comes into the OSA adapter, it goes up to the operating system by multiple interrupts. If you take the right side, we are trying to minimize latency. If you take the left side, we're trying to minimize CPU usage of the system Z. How do you control that? You do that through inbound performance, and it tells you also after how many packets is allowed to block before it interrupts your operating system. Now, I'm going to go all the way down to the bottom here. Inbound performance was initially implemented with three different values. Minimum CPU, basically say minimize the CPU utilization by blocking a lot of data together. Minimize latency by interrupting as soon as there is a packet in the OSA adapter, and then balance. A balance was a static value that was calculated by the OSA and the communication server, and then that would apply to all workloads that came in more or less forever on that OSA port. It didn't change, right? So it's a static value, but it tried to find a balance between those two minimize CPU user, minimize latency objectives. Now, the new one that came in at some point in time was dynamic. And generally, a recommendation is to use inbound performance dynamic today because dynamic will continually monitor and adjust the LAN idle timer to be the most optimal based on the workload at this point in time. Right, this is really what it will do. So generally, we recommend that you use a dynamic LAN idle timer today. Page 25 gives you just a brief overview of some of the performance data we've collected for that dynamic LAN idle timer. As you can see there, for this request response workload, we are actually able to favor that quite a bit in terms of transaction rate by using dynamic LAN idle timer instead of any of the other options that were available in this environment here. So yes, that's one thing we do recommend you do. OSA Express 3. You are aware, hopefully, that for the gigabit Ethernet feature and the 1000 base T Ethernet feature, there are four NIC ports on each adapter. Right. And that also means that there is a kind of a topology change here, and that is that a given chip ID with those two features supports two different ports. And the way you control that is through your TRLE definitions with a port keyword, and there are Appendix B has an example of how you do that. Just need to make sure that the old rule that says a chip ID equal to a port is no longer true with OSA Express 3. For gigabit and 1000 base D Ethernet, a chip ID is equal to different ports on this OSA adapter, so just keep that in mind. V1R11 enhancement that was put out was to make better use of the outbound priority queues that OSA supports. The only way you could have done that in the past was to configure your network quality of service policies and then map various types of information to one of those queues. For all practical purposes, none of you did that. So for all practical purposes, no one really took advantage of the four priority queues that the OSA outbound processing offers. In IR11, we gave you a new mechanism of using those through some definitions, what we call WLM priority queuing. And basically what it is a mechanism where we take the workload manager important level of the application that is writing the data down through the network interface and map that to one of those four priority queues. So if the importance level from workload manager perspective is high, or for example, a KIX address space, then the IP packets coming from that KIX address space will go into the high priority queue, whereas if it was a low priority address space, they're going to go into a lower priority outbound queue. So very, very simple way of actually benefiting from those priority queues. And again, there are some performance data on page 28 where we ran some workloads. And as you can see there, we are certainly able to favor request response, basically what we call high priority workload over streaming workload, which in this context here was lower priority workload. So just by changing that, actually using those outbound priority queues in a highly used OSA adapter, you could get performance benefits out of that. Now, this dynamic LAN idle time I just talked about a little bit earlier on, which was kind of a first step to improve this area, was taking one step further in release 11 with something which was called optimized latency mode. That's a configuration option you need to enable on an OSA Express 3 port to operate in this optimized latency mode. OLM is meant for workload that is transactional in nature and is very, very critical in terms of latency and transaction rates. Think about, for example, an SAP application server sitting outside ZOS and communicating with DB2 on ZOS. Tons of small transactions going back and forth there all the time, and the requirements for latency are pretty extreme in that type of environment. In that environment, when you enable OLM, OSA and CompServer implement some optimized processing that is directed towards that transactional type of workload. It means that it's not optimized for streaming workload. It is optimized for transactional workload. And there are whole tons of different tricks and stuff we do. I'm not going to go into all the technical details about that, but things like we're doing early interrupts and we're looking around and see data coming without waiting for stigase and stuff like that. The net of all this on page 30 is for transactional workload, the implications can be pretty impressive. If you look at the upper graph here, it's a latency improvements. If you look, for example, what we call RR40, that's 40 parallel sessions or connections sending 150 bytes in and receiving a K of bytes out. The base latency was about 820, 30, 40 microseconds. With OLM, that goes all the way down to under 400 microseconds. Similarly, the chart below that, or the graph below that, is a transaction rate. And again, there with RR40, you can see that we probably more than double that transaction rate for this workload by using OLM. So OLM is really something you need to look at if you have workloads that have demanding requirements for response time and latency and transaction rates and things like that. Don't enable OLM for workloads with streaming, because you're not going to get anything out of it, is the point there. This is really for high-volume transactional workload. You should expect quite significant improvements when you do that. It's even more aggressive than the dynamic LAN idle timer. So it's actually, if you take the dynamic LAN idle timer and then take OLM, it's kind of a progression along that way in supporting transactional workload. Only OSA Express 3 ports can do OLM, and only you have to define them with the interface statement. So that's one of the reasons why I talked about the interface statement early on. In release 11, you need some PTFs to do this. On release 12, this is all part of what is shipped from IBM. Now, if you define a ZOS TCP/IP stack interface enabling OLM on an OSA port, then we impose some restrictions on how many can share that OSA port. In fact, we reduce that to four interface definitions. So there's only four LPaaS stacks, interfaces, what have you, that can share an OSA port if it operates in OLM mode. And that has all to do with making sure that we don't destroy the algorithms or make life difficult for the algorithms that try to optimize this all the time, obviously. Pseudo acceleration, hyperflux acceleration will not work in OLM mode, and it's really only enabled for the high priority queue. What we actually do is we collapse traffic from queue 2 and 3 into queue 1 when OLM is enabled. So that's a little detail you might want to, if you start looking at the data and start wondering why isn't anything going out on queue 2 and 3, that was on purpose. Queue acceleration was another release 11 function where we moved routing between QDO and hypersockets down into the data link control layer in order to speed up that type of processing. That includes, and this is probably the most important part, that includes Sysplex distributor connection routing. The connection routing will also go that way through. So if I have connections that are distributed because Sysplex distributor for the LPAR, then all the packets that come in belonging to that connection will actually be forwarded to the other LPAR down in the DLC layer. It doesn't have to go up through the different layers in TCP/IP. But Sysplex distributor connection routing, that has a significant implication how much CPU time we use for doing that connection routing, as you can see on page 33. In R12, we take this concept of multiple outbound priority queues one step further and start working with multiple inbound queues also. Before release 12, all inbound data from an OSAT app came through a single queue into the operating system. In R12, we will from TCP/IP be able to create up to three different inbound queues. One is just basically everything else, and the two others are specifically for Sysplex distributor traffic, and the other one is for bulk traffic. And the whole idea here is to make sure that Sysplex distributor traffic gets optimal, you know, performance through the DLC layer, and not being disturbed by bulk traffic. And bulk traffic does not get disturbed in terms of packets arriving out of sequence up through the TCP layer. Right? So this is another step in terms of improving inbound performance on the from the OSA adapter. We mentioned dynamic LAN idle timer earlier. That is actually now maintained per inbound queue in this type of environment. So basically optimized based on the individual queue. There are some performance data already here. I'm not going to go into the details of that. One more little thing I want to talk about before we have to wrap up here, because I can see we're already behind schedule. In R12 is a new display TCP/IP command I highly recommend you start playing around with. It's a display TCP/IP ….OSA info. And the idea about this is that it hopefully will allow you to move from OSA SF for debugging purposes to just do this display command. It will include information about the OSA addressing table and a whole lot of other things that are hidden within the OSA adapter today, and will actually make that visible directly on your MVS console. So go and look at this command as soon as you get R12 up and running. 36, I mentioned those two networks in the enterprise environment, the management network and the inter-ensemble data network. Those are really QDIO ports, OSA ports. They're defined the two new chip IDs, OSM and OSX. OSM is the management network and OSX is the data network. And I think Gus and Jerry already did a session about Z Enterprise. Otherwise, that is certainly one of the things we will do in the future. There's lots of things to talk about there. The last thing I'm just going to refer to is this segmentation offload story. I have so far said, proceed with caution. I think it's safe now to say that you can actually go on with segmentation offload. It seems to be safe at this point in time. And why would you do it? Page 38 kind of explains to you why you would actually use segmentation offload. There are CPU cycles to save is the whole point if you are doing streaming outbound traffic from your ZOS LPAS. Right. Now, as I expected, we were not going to get time for some of the remaining parts of this presentation here. And, if any of you have any questions about what I call flat network designs and dynamic bypass and things like that, by all means, send me notes and let me know, and I will help with it. And the material is obviously in the PDF file that Arnie has made available to all of you.
Thank you, Alfred. I really appreciate you presenting today.